Well, the one thing I would tell people is the biggest thing I've been told and I've realized is if you work really hard and you're good at hitting your schedule, mm-hmm. because remember, it's the business side that hires people, not the art side.
Yeah.
If you are good at hitting your schedule, you do good work. It doesn't have to be the best on the group, but it needs to be reliable. Because as a director, if I could get a storyboard artist that I didn't have to worry about, mm-hmm. my life was so much easier. Mm-hmm. So you be that person. You be that indispensable person. You don't have to be the star. Mm-hmm. Because trust me, the star costs more and they get laid off first. Mm-hmm. So you want to be that person who delivers on time, is consistent. You can be a little bit of a problem every once in a while. Pretty much here at Disney, I've always been a stealth employee. I've been a Band-Aid. I do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's how I fall into things, because my name gets around with the people who hire, not necessarily other artists. And yeah, sometimes I'm like, well, but this guy is just so much more popular than me. But in the end, I'm like, well, yeah, but they like me anyway, and they give me the job. So what the hell?
Hello. You're listening to Ink and Paint Girls, a podcast celebrating women in animation, and where we explore the ups and downs of making a career for yourself in cartoons. I'm Cassie Soliday, and today we're talking with Melissa Suber, Disney fine artist and storyboard artist on the Lion Guard TV show. Today, Melissa Suber has joined us for our podcast, and we're really eager to have her. So, you're a storyboard artist on the Lion Guard at Disney TV right now.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Can you tell us, like how you got started and, like, how long you've been in the industry?
Sure. I got started back in, 1994. I had a good friend. Well, not a good friend. His mom was a friend of my mom's. And they went to church together. And they suggested that when I came out here to try animation, that I should give him a call. His name was Toby Shelton, mm-hmm. and he's the guy who designed Darkwing Duck and all that stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's awesome. And he was really nice, and he actually hired me. He wasn't my first job, but he was my first job at Disney on Quack Pack. Mm-hmm. And I was a revisionist. My first job was for the Hearst family, the newspaper people.
Oh,
and
wow.
They are crazy. On a show called Phantom 2040. And the situation with that one was I had a friend I had met out here once I had moved out here. And he was the art director. Mm-hmm. And the Northridge earthquake happened. And all his artwork blew out onto the street because the windows exploded.
Ah.
So he called me up one night and said, can you do 5-point perspective? And I said, sure. Lied through my teeth because I had no idea what it was. And he said, bring a pencil to work tomorrow. And that's my very first job. Mm-hmm. Then I was laid off for a while because that happens.
Yeah.
And then I was hired on to Dennis the Menace to do layout, which is what I actually came out here to do,
mm-hmm.
because I always liked the environments. Yeah. And from there, it just snowballed into contact job, contact job, contact job. I've been very lucky. Like I said, it's been since 1994, 95. I've been steadily employed all the time, except for 2 years where I chose to take off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's, I've been cool. Very lucky, but I've also worked my ass off. Mm-hmm. I hope we can cuss.
Yeah, for okay. sure. Okay. Well, that's great that you got to decide you wanted the hiatus.
Yeah, I got frustrated. I had been working on the Tinkerbell videos, mm-hmm. and I got an offer to work on a feature at IDT, which is now Starz,
mm-hmm.
and they blew through their budget for the whole year, and so we were laid off by their forensic accountant, which was fun. But they paid out our contract. And I was also doing children's books at that time. I illustrate children's books on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to what I call the tipping point, where I was making as much doing the children's books for Warner Brothers as I was doing animation.
Mm-hmm.
And I got tired of badly run studios, so I took 2 years off.
Mm. Have you run into that a lot, badly run studios?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Like, why do you think that is?
Because you get a lot of people who have MBAs, you know, business degrees, who either think or want to be creatives, and they don't ask us how to do it.
Mm.
So you get a business mindset running a creative venture, And they tend to lose track of the fact that it is a business, but there's a human element. So they get all creative at front, and it's all fun at first, and everybody's happy. And then all of a sudden, their schedule, which they have to meet for business, doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so everything falls apart. And, of course, we get laid off. Most of them stay.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
interesting.
Or they greenlight things and they don't do R&D, which is very common nowadays. And the creators are nuts. Sometimes that happens. No offense to the creators, but yeah, you're nuts.
Yeah. I think to deal with some of the stuff they have to deal with, you kind of have to be.
Yeah, I mean, as an artist, you're allowed to be nuts. That's the joy. But as a business, a person who runs a business, it's not helpful. And a lot of artists I talk to, you need to really understand the business of animation in order to be truly successful in it, if you're going to run a show or if you're going to pitch a show.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is business. I mean, it's all money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they keep shows for money, or they lose shows because they're not making money. And that's what it comes down to.
So how do you feel? Because it sounds like you have a really good, great understanding about the business of animation, which is probably what's helped you continue to get jobs.
Yes, because I understand both sides.
Yeah. So how did you develop that knowledge of both sides?
Well, I've been a working artist since I was 16. Mm-hmm. So I've actually had to run my own businesses. I've been a director. So you get to see the side of the business that other artists don't see. And there's a lot of things the artists aren't told and that don't have to deal with because it's just easier that way.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom ran her own business. So I have that business acumen kind of built in just from how I was raised and kind of how I think, you know, as a freelance artist, which we all are at this point, because we're not under contract, you're running your own business. And so if I sign up with somebody or I sign on to a show, I need to know, okay, certain aspects of it. I need to hold up my end, but I also need to know what their part of it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I come into a show and they, in fact, I got an offer today.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah, but it's for a studio I worked with before. And what they are asking me to do is physically impossible to do in the time they want to do it in and for the money they want.
Oh, I'm sure.
So I'm sitting there going, well, I would love to help you out, but you've set it up to make it impossible to do this job.
Yeah. I think that happens especially with production schedules. Like, they're set up to fail.
Yeah.
And it feels like some are a lot of copy and paste, honestly.
Well, people, and you can ask people around Disney especially, because they are taught a certain way to do shows. For the most part, it works. Mm-hmm. If they're given the right amount of time. And they always pad in, which is good. A lot of places, including Disney now, they do a schedule based on numbers. They forget the human element. The fact that people get sick, the fact that people have a bad drawing day, the fact that sometimes you get a script that is just really hard to deal with on all levels. And they've never worked it out to include that in the scheduling process for most shows. There are some shows like our show, Vanguard, we actually do have someone who's been through it enough that he pads our schedule pretty well.
Fantastic.
We eat it up, of course,
yeah.
But it's like, okay, we're not too bad.
Yeah.
And we're not too far behind yet.
Does he take into account each script once they're written?
No.
That's
the problem.
Because that's a huge deal, because some scripts are bigger than others.
Exactly. And he can't, unfortunately, because he makes the schedule probably about 7 months before the scripts are written.
Yeah, makes sense.
I mean, you compensate. It's like when I do freelance, if I get a script that has 10 pages, and I'm like, okay, great, here's my flat fee, I'm like, I'll read through it first, and I will adjust if there's music, like songs you have to do.
Yeah.
Or an action scene that is like one line, like car chase ensues, and you know it's going to take you 3 days to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I work that in when I negotiate my contract. A lot of people just go forward without it. And that's what I try to tell people, especially if they're new. It's like, you do actually have a lot of control because you're the one who's saying how much you're worth. So if you come to me and you say, oh, I only pay $400 a page, I'm like, okay, how much time do I have? Because I learned this and people who business know this, you have three things you can control in any negotiation. Quality of what you do, which is how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
The money you get paid, or the time it takes. You should be in control of at least one of those, if not two.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want high quality, they either pay me more or give me more time. If they pay me less, they're going to get less quality, and I can do it in less time. Or if they want to pay me less, I always ask for more time. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly, as an artist or as the client, you can control, but you always have to give up one. That's the problem.
Yeah. See, I think for people just starting out, they're afraid to ask for anything right. more than what the contract says.
Which is understandable.
Yeah, totally. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, there's this whole debate going around, started by my friend Steve Silver, about working for free. And I totally agree with him for the most part. As a newbie, you don't want to turn down work because you do need to build your portfolio. I would say if someone's asking you to work for free for exposure, make sure the exposure is worth it. Do research. Don't just take them at the word that, oh, we have this great website and you're going to be on this. And I always check out the website. And if it's a crap website, I don't do it. Okay. Yeah. If I've worked for free in the beginning, usually very small, very short jobs. The first job I got, I went from making $7 an hour part-time at the zoo to making $1,000 a week. I had to ask them, a week? is this not a month? And they're like, yeah, it's a week. I didn't need to negotiate that. You know, it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Nowadays, most studios won't approach me with anything too much less than what I get. Mm-hmm. You know, because I've learned pretty much where my level is that I'm comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get more. I never get less because I found that if you find out your lowest amount you can take for a job, either in your heart or paying your rent, one or the other, then you don't go below that. If they offer below that, you say, no, I need at least as much. Mm-hmm. If you can negotiate higher, always ask for more. They can always say no. You can always say, you know, I'd like to make this much, but can we talk about it? And if they say, no, this is our budget, then you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I can respect a budget if it's truly the budget. Mm-hmm. And some people, well, some studios like Disney and stuff have a little bit of a wiggle room. Mm-hmm. Whether they say so or not, they do. It's not much, but it's a little bit. Independent studios, smaller studios like Cosmic Toast and places like that, they don't have as much wiggle room. So you go in knowing you're going to an independent, so your price is going to be pretty much close to whatever they offer. And that's okay. I would say understand that if you do a job for less than you want to, understand that you're doing that and don't resent it. Mm. If you are working really hard and getting paid nothing and you're starting to get angry, you negotiated wrong and you shouldn't have taken the job. Mm. The fear of not getting the job, well, it's real. And there's a lot of jobs out there that make you feel like it's the only one left. There are some years that are like that. Mm-hmm. I had years where I couldn't really get more than what was offered. Mm-hmm. Lately, though, there's a lot of work out there.
So, is it strictly in TV where it's kind of booming?
A lot of it's in TV because features that are hit and miss. And you have to have a certain temperament to work in features. I mean, I applied, but as I talked to people, they were like, you may not like it.
Because, why?
Well, in TV, we do like 20 minutes of a show in 5 to 6 weeks, depending on the show you're on.
Mm-hmm. And that's for storyboarding.
And that's coming up with the idea, and you're usually on a script. With features, you have no script usually. You usually have kind of an outline to begin with. They eventually get you a script. Mm-hmm. And you are given a scene or sequence, and you have 2 or 3 months, and they redo it and redo it and redo it and redo it and redo it. Yeah, no. They get beautiful work, and I love the idea of it, but having been in the situation where I'm in, I like giving scenes a couple shots and then moving on. If it's my own work, of course, I'll work it to death. But if it's someone else's script, I want to be able to get close to what they have in mind. And if I can't nail that, I feel like I fail. So if you're spending 5 or 6 months doing a scene, you feel like you failed if it doesn't nail it.
Yeah.
What I found is I love DVDs because they give you enough time to work a story and character, but it's not 5 years.
And this is movies that go straight to DVD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or specials, or now they're streaming them, which is great.
Yeah.
So that might open up a little bit more, which is wonderful. So you get that feeling of a long form, but on a more short form schedule, but not like breakneck like we do in TV.
Yeah.
So it's a nice break.
Yeah. So going back to the concept of, payment and what you're worth, like, did you always know how much you were worth?
No.
Like, how did you explore that?
What I tell everyone who asks me this is you have to ask people. Don't be afraid to go up to an artist and say, what do you think you would get paid for this? Go online. There's lots of resources. Mm-hmm. How much does a storyboard artist get for TV? Go to the union, and that's a good start. Yeah. Independents don't usually pay that much, but it's a good start. Tell someone what the project is and what they're asking. Someone who does what I do, like at my level, and 90% of us will tell you. I had someone who asked me about doing an illustration it was character design. That's what it was. And she was brand new and it was for a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So that always comes into play too. But he was paying her, I think, $50 per illustration, black and white design with changes and color. And I said, that's too low, even for a friend. Because you have to think of how long is that going to take you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned through illustration and other things. I just asked around, how much should this be? And it ranges. Like, if I were to do a color illustration of one character, depending on how many changes there are, it can run anywhere from $300 to $700. And you just have to judge.
Mm-hmm.
If you're new, you charge less. And you learn as you go along how much is comfortable to charge. Mm-hmm. Some people charge more than me, but I wouldn't feel comfortable with certain people charging that much.
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, I'm worth it, but I know their budget.
Yeah.
And that's just not fair.
Yeah.
Or sometimes I had people who approached me and I told them and they're like, well, we can't afford you. And I'm like, okay, that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. A lot of times you have to figure out how you want to get paid. You can get paid by the hour, and sometimes if you're working in a studio, you just break down your hourly rate and you add a little bit on because you're paying for insurance and stuff like that. You can charge for a flat fee for the project, which I would say is fine as long as you have all the terms very clear, because that can come back and bite you in the ass. Because they can come back and say, oh, we want 62 changes, and if that's not written down that they can't do that, you have a flat fee, you have to do it.
Yeah.
And then the third way, which not many people do, illustrators do it, and I do it sometimes, is to charge a day rate. And that can be anywhere from $500 to $10,000, depending on who you are.
Mm.
Okay, so that's more for people who've been around for a while, because they can ask for it.
Mm.
Newbies, they're going to look at you like, really?
Yeah. Well, I feel like when people start, like, exploring that idea of like, so how much is like my skill worth? I feel like underneath that, it's about how much you're worth to yourself.
Very much so.
Like, do you have any stories or insight on that?
Yeah. Cause I mean, when I started, I definitely underpriced myself. There was no doubt, because I was just, I'm like, oh, I can work on this. This is great. And they'd ask how much should I charge? And I'd say something and I'd get no pushback. And at first it didn't bother me, but then it's like, hey, that was very easy. Easy to say yes to that.
Yeah.
I had a friend who actually is, I don't know if he's at Disney Features anymore, but he was an illustrator, very good painter. And I told him what was going on. And he's like, well, how much is an hour of your time worth? And of course I'm like, whatever they'll pay. As you learn what your skill is worth, as you get better at what you do, your confidence will build. There's still that hard thing where artists have trouble, especially women, pricing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I just kind of take a stab at it. And that's where I'm asking other people what they get paid. So if I ask someone who's been working in the business 20 years, what would you charge for this? And they say, oh, $1,500. I'll knock that back to about $700 for me because I don't have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was doing that, a friend of mine said, no, charge $1,000. Ask for $15. They might pay it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, if they really want to work with you, will negotiate with you,
mm-hmm.
which builds that confidence. So, like, I do fine art painting on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I show in two galleries in Tokyo. And I was talking to my representative, and because we were pricing things out here in the States, and he said, we had someone approach and ask about a painting. It was a gallery owner and should have known better, but they offered something and he's like, no, we can't sell it to you for this. Because her paintings in Japan are selling for X amount. And if we sell it to you for much lower than that, we insult the galleries in Japan. Basically, my price is set without me trying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, am I comfortable with that? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes mm-hmm. I want more. But experience will bring confidence with pricing yourself. You will always kind of doubt it unless you're doing a job you really don't want to do, then you'll know exactly what to price.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got to make be worth your time,
yeah.
Especially if you don't like it.
What you said earlier about, like, not resenting it. If mm-hmm. you're not resenting it, then that's probably a good price
exactly.
for you.
Exactly. Or it's a great project and you're willing to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I do that. It's like, yeah, this is an awesome project. I'll work for cheaper just to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of people independent approaching me. And what I find with them is they just don't know what the prices are. And when they find out, they are usually really shocked.
Yeah,
that's when you have just to educate them. You
mm-hmm.
know, a lot of people, they don't know what artists should get paid. Artists should know what artists should get paid. So if you educate people who approach you, we all get paid more in the end or get paid what we should, because now the
mm-hmm.
client actually understands that if you want 2 minutes of animation, it's going to cost you a couple grand.
Yes.
Not $200,
mm-hmm.
which is what they think. Because,
mm-hmm.
oh, you're an artist, you like drawing. No.
Yeah.
So
you need to preserve your strength in your wrists so you can actually work on things that you want to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing you take into account. Is this job that you're getting paid X amount for taking away from your personal work, and how much is that worth to you?
Yeah.
I've worked on, I want to say about 4 shows that I didn't even put my name on.
Oh, wow.
That were strictly just got to pay the rent this month.
Did you get to decide that you didn't want your name on those shows?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing.
It's a thing. You can do that.
Okay.
I'm not sure how it works with union shops. These were not union shops. But sometimes I look at the project and I'm like, hey, I really don't want to be attached to that.
Yeah.
But it was great work at the time because I needed the money.
Yeah. So you take into account the content that you're creating for then?
I do now. When I was new, you take what comes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you look at it, you're like, okay, I guess I'll work on that.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for me, I turned down 2 shows based on what they were. And what I tell people is, do I fit that show?
Mm-hmm.
One, just recently, they asked me to test for Brickleberry. And it was nice of them to ask, but that's so not my show.
Mm.
And so I just turned down the test flat out because I knew, I could pass the test, but it's not my type of show.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be having fun on it. And I would always be looking for something else, which isn't fair to that show, because you don't want, as I've hired people, I don't want them looking for other jobs as they're working on my show.
Yeah.
So.
Because also their passion for waivers.
Exactly.
And then they don't do their best work.
Exactly.
So what is your ideal show?
The one I'm on, actually.
Yeah, Lion Guard?
Yeah. It's so great because, first of all, it's animals, and I love drawing animals.
Yeah.
The crew, most of the support staff, the production staff, I know from way back when.
That's amazing.
The director, Howie's really laid back, very hands off. Basically, he directs like I do, which is if you give me something that works, I'm cool with it.
Mm-hmm.
If I have something in mind, I'll tell you. But pretty much, I trust you to do your job.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rare thing because most new people who come in with a show, and some old people, there's a control factor where it's just their personality, but unfortunately it makes us as artists feel like they don't trust us to do our job.
Yeah.
With Howie, he's great.
Mm-hmm. And Howie's your showrunner?
Howie's our director. Our showrunner is Ford.
Okay.
And
Ford
I've never
Riley.
Worked with Ford, but I've been around him. And
it's a really cool name.
Yeah. And he's really nice. He's kind of, both of them are very hard to read sometimes. So you're like, do you like it or not? I can't tell. But they're really nice guys. In fact, I came from a studio just recently where I never got any thank you, no good job, no nothing for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I came here and Howie was always very sure to at least once or twice come by and tell us we had a good job done. And the other, actually last night, Ford comes in and he says, I need to talk to you. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm in trouble. Like, what didn't work? He's like, I just want to let you know that we're very happy you're on the show. And I see your boards come through and I'm like, great, no problem. So it's so nice for them to make that effort.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people don't because when you're busy, you don't think about that.
Yeah.
And of course, all my co-artists are amazing. Mm-hmm. We have a very strong crew, a very seasoned crew, mm-hmm. with a couple of newbies. We have a new revisionist she tried the boards a little bit over her level, but she recognized that. But all we did is they put her in revisions, mm-hmm. which is great because it gives her a chance to hone the skills that were missing. And she's really close. I mean, she's not that far off. And then move her into boards when it's time.
And I heard it was the extra mile she went for those boards, which got her to her storyboard revisionist gig.
Yes, because she put in the heart. And especially with that crew, if you prove that you're just really trying, even though you may not be there yet, that's what they really respect. Because we have enough people who can carry it we can mentor a couple people.
Yeah.
Up through the ranks.
Not too many.
Not too many because we still have to hit a deadline, but a couple.
And I feel like that's so, like, the rough thing about getting into TV, especially TV. I mean, feature probably as well. But, like, there's so many people these days coming out of college. And so it's just flooded with these new graduates, but also, like, veterans who are still, like, going job to job.
Yeah.
And there's just not a lot of room in the budget nor schedule to take new people on all the time.
Sometimes, yeah. And you find once you're in the industry, it is who you know. And most people are loyal to the people who work hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, I wasn't sure I was going to get a line guard because Howie was working with the guys on Jake, and if they hadn't gotten another season, chances are there would be only two openings on Lion Guard for Borders because he would move with his crew, which is great unless you're on the outside.
Yeah, exactly.
What I find, and I wish they would change it, that used to be different, but you need an apprenticeship built in, not an internship, but an apprenticeship so that if someone comes in as a revisionist, you're teaching them how to board. They don't do that very much anymore. And unfortunately, a lot of the guys coming out of college, they're very talented artists in a sense, but they've never worked production. Mm-hmm. And they're usually shell-shocked on the first show they work on because they don't realize, oh, we got to get this done in 4 weeks, not one semester.
And one semester is pretty tough in its own.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. It's like, oh, crap. Yeah. And especially recently, you get a lot of show creators who have great ideas, but because they don't have production experience, they bring all their buddies from college who don't have production experience, and they get a show greenlit. Everything's great except when they can't deliver the show, and that's not good. So everybody listening, learn how a show is made, how much time it takes or how little time it takes, what has to be done, because it's really bad for your rep if you get a show sold and it's canceled after 6 episodes because you can't deliver to the overseas studios or the Canadian studio.
Yeah.
On the outside, you look great. But within the industry, you already have a ding on your first time out and you don't want that.
Yeah. It's a small industry.
It's a very small industry.
Yeah, I think there's some good advice in, like, the slow but steady.
Yes.
Like, get an internship in production and learn about production and then try to go out for entry-level artist jobs.
Yeah, or come in at entry-level, which I did, which was a revisionist. Mm-hmm. My first job at Disney, I was a revisionist on Quack Pack, Gargoyles, and Aladdin all at the same time.
Oh, what?
Yeah. You learn a lot you get that many artist boards in front of you.
So, like, how was your week? Was it, like, this week would be on one show and then the next week? Or, like, you were working on all three?
All three every day. I had a whiteboard that was divided up, and I would get notes from each director during the day, and I would turn them around. And most of them were pretty smooth. Some were a little rough, and I learned to just yell at people.
Wow.
Like, decide what you want now. But it was a great training area. I was on at Hey Arnold, and I was a revisionist, and they got a couple boards in that were bad. So I would start revisions, then I got a sequence to fix. which is great. Then I got like half a script to fix. And then I got Jamie came in and said, okay, the board doesn't work. Do it. I'm like, should I use the board? He's like, no, here's the script. And I'm like, okay, now we need to talk about my job. Because I'm no longer a revisionist.
Yeah.
So along the way, I've been a revisionist, let's see, at Nickelodeon on Hey Arnold.
Yeah.
I was a revisionist on, well, here at Disney. Mm-hmm. 2 years at Nickelodeon, 2 years here. And then I was a revisionist for DreamWorks for about 6 weeks. And then my director's like, oh, no, you're going to move up to director. And, of course, that freaked me out completely.
You moved up to director.
Not director, sorry. My director moved me up to storyboard.
Oh, I see. But you have directed, though.
Oh, yeah. I directed 2 years ago now. 2012-13, mm-hmm. La La Loopsie.
Yeah. And so, like, you have so much experience revising and storyboarding. Mm-hmm. Did that freak you out to go up to directing? I know we're skipping ahead a little bit.
Well, it was a weird situation to get into directing. I was working at Mike Young, which is now Splash. It was after I'd taken the 2 years off. So it was kind of hard to get back in the industry at that time. It was kind of a low point in the industry. Not a lot of jobs were being done. Mm-hmm. We go in cycles, and I just have the wonderfully brilliant ability to come in at the lowest part possible. I came out here originally in October, and I'm like, oh, no one's hiring in October. Okay. So when this happened, I was like, okay. So I had a friend who was doing backgrounds, and he, on Facebook, said, hey, I got a new job. I congratulated him. I said, hey, pass my name around if they're looking for people. He's like, they're looking now. Bring your portfolio by. So I brought my portfolio by, and they hired me as boarders on these series of DVDs. Well, the director and the head of story at the time had a falling out within about 6 weeks. And I came in on a Monday. My director called me down. He's like, you're now head of story. I'm like, okay, you might want to ask, but okay. And unfortunately, he hadn't told the head of story that I was head of story at this. Yeah, it was really fun. So the head of story was coming up and giving me direction and asked me, why are you working on that script? And I couldn't tell him anything.
Oh my gosh.
So I did head of story for about three of those DVDs. Two of those DVDs. Then it transferred into kind of a head of story assistant director position.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was thinking of leaving, and they called me back. They're like, well, we have this show coming up, Lala. We'd like you to come on as head of story. I'm like, okay, great. I'm now used to this. And that's another area where I had to learn to price myself because I was going from project to project to project, but not asking for a raise. And my director's like, ask for a raise. I'm like, okay. It's good when people help you.
Yeah.
You know, elevate yourself. So at that point, I came in, and the job was kind of a bait switch because it was really assistant director, not head of story, because they didn't have a full crew at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And with smaller studios, you find that. And so I was production manager, art director, head of story.
What?
Within the first 6 weeks, 6 months, I did that for 6 months. And I said, either you hire more people or I quit.
Yeah. I just don't understand how you would have time to be a production manager.
Yeah.
Because that's like the complete business side of animation.
Yeah. And in a small studio, the producer was helping with the scheduling and all the stuff. As production manager, I had to deal with hiring the people and talking out problems and oh, this person's upset, what do you do? I had to make sure doors were
whole world to take care of. It was people's issues.
It was nuts, and we had some issues. Oh my gosh. So what happened with that at that point is there was some negotiation with another production, and they had promised someone a director credit. I was actually doing more work because of the nature of our show than she was. And so my executive director went to the head of studio and said, either they both get director or they both get assistant director. So they gave us both director title. Mm-hmm. I was still directing and I went on and did the second season of that show. So that's, I tend to fall into things.
Yeah. That's a nice talent to have.
It is.
And I don't feel like it happens for enough. Well, obviously it doesn't happen for enough people because there's not enough places for people to fall into exactly. Like that.
Well, the one thing I would tell people is the biggest thing I've been told and I've realized is if you work really hard and you're good at hitting your schedule, mm-hmm. because remember, it's the business side that hires people, not the art side.
Yeah.
If you are good at hitting your schedule, you do good work. It doesn't have to be the best on the group, but it needs to be reliable. Because as a director, if I could get a storyboard artist that I didn't have to worry about, mm-hmm. my life was so much easier. Mm-hmm. So you be that person. You be that indispensable person. You don't have to be the star. Mm-hmm. Because trust me, the star costs more and they get laid off first. Mm-hmm. So you want to be that person who delivers on time, is consistent. You can be a little bit of a problem every once in a while. Pretty much here at Disney, I've always been a stealth employee. I've been a Band-Aid. I do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's how I fall into things because my name gets around with the people who hire, not necessarily other artists. And yeah, sometimes I'm like, well, but this guy is just so much more popular than me. But in the end, I'm like, well, yeah, but they like me anyway, and they give me the job. So what the hell? Yeah.
So do you, like, does networking also help get your name around? Because, I mean, it if does. You're just only in your cubicle working, you know, only the people that you report to know who you are.
Yeah, I would say you always should get up and walk around, talk to other shows, and please, and this is what I tell most people, but when I was at Disney before, in the 2000, say, before I left to go to Stars, Disney had kind of a cleaning of house type thing. They mm. revamped. Pixar was coming in, so they were letting a lot of people go, and that happens. Mm. A lot of people who were getting let go had never worked anywhere else. That is a bad plan of action. With the world of animation the way it is now, with so many outlets and so many studios, small and big, I think it's a very good plan to work at least two other studios, even if it's freelance. Because at first I thought bouncing around was a bad thing. When layoffs came, I had names in every single studio to call. Mm-hmm. People who knew me, and not only artists, but actually production people. Mm-hmm. And that saved my butt 90% of the time. Because it's like, oh, I worked at Nickelodeon. I worked here. Cartoon Network didn't hire me because they tend to hire only CalArts people, which I understand. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, they have a very young group over there.
Yeah. And, you know, it's who you know, and it's usually from CalArts. And I didn't go to CalArts, so yeah. I kind of got screwed. Warner Brothers, it's weird. But yeah, it's, I would say definitely network around your own studio. Network other studios. Go to the union parties. Go to the drawing classes. There's a great drawing group that I was doing for a little while that would have drink and draw.
Mm, that sounds fun.
Basically, they go to a bar downtown and draw and drink and talk.
Yeah.
And it's not that you need to meet a lot of people. Understand who you're meeting. Mm-hmm. Is this person another storyboard artist? That's a good contact. Is this person a prop designer? Maybe not so much a good contact. Still a good name to know because mm-hmm. you never know where they're going to end up.
Yeah.
Don't always go for the director, because most of the time directors don't show up to these things. I make friends with production people because they know what's going on.
Yeah.
A lot more than the artists do. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much, everybody's on the same level with me. I don't care if you're just starting out, if you've been in the business forever. Of course, there are people I admire immensely. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to talk to you however you are. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're new, okay, we'll bring it to a level that will help you. But I'm not going to kiss ass just because you happen to be a director. You know, if I like your work, I'll tell you I like your work. You know,
yeah,
that's it.
I wish everyone would do that. Like,
it's hard because nice. I don't understand why people don't. It's like we're all artists. I mean, I worked at the zoo for about a year and stars would come through. Mm-hmm. I mean, big movie stars. In fact, the crew from Lion King came through to draw the movie while I was working there. Sucked.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm like, really?
That's so fortuitous, though, you know?
I know. And I'm like, what can I do? They're like, well, just apply. And I'm like, shoot me now.
I worked in the Disney parks, and whenever I'd meet an animator, I'd be like, no, give me better advice.
Give me a contact name. But, you know, actors and people like that, I'm not necessarily starstruck. Mm-hmm. There are a few. Like, I met Leonard Nimoy, and I had to go up and talk to the man. He's taking his grandkid through the zoo, but I'm like, I'm just going to tell him I like his work, you know.
Nice.
But I'm not going to fall over myself, because they're artists like we are. They work like we are. When I was at DreamWorks, you know, Spielberg used to come by the studio and have meetings. One day, he gets in an elevator. One of my coworkers at the time, asks him for his autograph. It's like, he's your boss. Spielberg never came by the studio again.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Jeez. Because he doesn't want to be that boss. You know, he already is. He's not a star. He's your boss. He pays your paycheck.
Yeah.
You don't ask your boss for his autograph. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so with those experiences, I was like, you know what? They're like us. They came out to Hollywood. They're trying to make it like we are.
Mm-hmm. So. Where are you from?
New Mexico.
New Mexico?
Albuquerque.
Okay. So you moved out here for animation then.
Yes. I had just graduated from Northern Arizona, which is in Flagstaff, with a BS in visual communication, which is what they offered. And came out here because I figured I like animation. I'll give it a try. I'm young enough. I can change my career if it doesn't work out.
Do you have a plan B? Like right now?
Well, right now, yeah. It's not technically a plan B because it's not a safety net. It's more like, what else do I want to do?
That's a nice place to be.
Yes, it is.
I like that.
Well, you get to that point because it's like, well, it's not really a safety net anymore because I'm not afraid of falling so much.
Yeah.
As you get older, you're not afraid of falling so much out of your job. Falling downstairs,
I cannot wait for that.
Yeah, it does come. It takes a while, and I think it helped that I stepped out and did struggle a little bit and got to really figure out, okay, what about animation do I like? Because after so many years, you tend to forget what you like about it because it is such a business. But yeah, my joy, because I always ask myself the lottery question. What would I do if I had all the money I needed, right? And it was about a year ago or so because I had some health issues. And I realized, oh, well, I'm doing what I want on the side anyway. I paint and I write. I would do that if I had winnings anyway. Would I storyboard? Maybe. I wouldn't do it at a studio. I'd do my own thing. So I'm pretty close to doing what my backup plan is. When I first came out here, I had a quasi-backup plan to get a teaching degree. Because my mom ran her own school. I taught at her school. I'm a fairly decent teacher. Kids like me. So that was the backup plan. Never really pursued it. I did odd jobs instead because getting certified in California to teaching at the time was more difficult than it is now. And it just didn't pay anything more than a part-time job did at the time either.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah. And B plans are fine, but sometimes it's good not to have one because it makes you work harder.
That's a good point.
But mentally, I'm not the person who can do that because I'm a planner. I'm kind of a Boy Scout at heart. I always like to be prepared. and so not having the option is weird. It's why I bought my house, because my house is my safety net financially. Because if things go south, I just sell the house and I'm okay.
Yeah.
Buying the house was scary as hell. But selling it, you know, and my financial advisor, who's a friend of the family, you know, I called her up crying. I'm like, did I do the right thing? She's like, yes. So, yeah, you learn other ways of having safety nets, working in other studios, making sure I know people in other places, doing the illustration on the side. You know, I want secondary streams of income anyway. I mean, I did web design. I did graphic design for the Prostate Cancer Society or Foundation for two years straight because it was like, okay, we've budgeted this much per month, no matter how much work you do. Awesome. Boring work because I've done graphic design and I like it at first and then it gets really boring fast. But I figured, okay, 2 years of extra income, great, you know. And I would say, as artists in this industry especially, always look at other ways to bring in a little income. Not necessarily that make you work harder, but, you know, keep that in mind because when things go south and there are no jobs, it is very scary. When you get that layoff notice, you have a month left, you're like,
and I think at Disney, you have to get at least 40 hours notice.
So yeah, you get 1 week.
Get
notice.
A month always.
No, sometimes, most time you get 2 weeks. I've been at places, my first job for the Hearst, not the Hearst family. That was Dennis the Menace. I was told Friday at 5 o'clock that I was fired.
What?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Amazingly terrible. My crew was great. They started stealing things for me. I'm like, put that back. Oh my God. They're like, we're getting mad for you. I'm like, I'm not mad. I mean, it was one of my first jobs. I'm like, I guess this is how it works.
Yeah. That's so cool. That's so cool of you to be so cool about it.
Yeah. I mean, if now, oh yeah, I'd be mad. But then I'm kind of obnoxious sometimes in terms of what I think is justice and the right way to deal with people. So even though I got laid off at 5 o'clock on Friday, by the producer at the time, I went in Monday and I went into the director's office and I said, I would have had a lot more respect for you if you'd fired me yourself. And I walked out.
Ooh.
Cause I'm like, okay, you're a chicken shit for doing it this way. And you had someone else do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you did it in order to get your friend into the position that I was in.
That sucks.
Yeah.
And there was no protection because that's non-union, right?
It's non-union, yeah.
And that probably happens a lot.
It does. And so I was like, you know what? There's nothing I can do to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But I will definitely let you be aware that I am aware of why and how you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wrong.
Damn, and that was your first job. Mm-hmm. You were some gutsy gal.
Yeah. Well, at that point, in a weird way, you have nothing to lose. You get about halfway through your career and you're like, oh crap, I have everything to lose. And then you get to where I'm at now and I'm like, eh, I have nothing to lose again because I'll go find something else.
And something we've just kind of grazed upon is like your side hustles. Like, you know, you have paintings over in Tokyo, was it?
Yeah, I'm showing Disney licensed paintings. So it's Disney subject,
mm-hmm.
Into galleries in Tokyo. And they've done pretty well. Not huge, but pretty well. And then they make prints from them.
That's awesome.
So
yeah, we're getting in the parks. I got to see how that whole business worked. And I'm like, this is very interesting. Yeah. Like, I didn't realize that, you know, they give licenses to artists and they make this stuff.
Yeah, in fact, my stuff is sold in the parks.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
My friends take pictures. Hey, here's your picture. I'm like, did you buy it? They're like, no. Okay.
It's probably expensive.
And yeah, I mean, like I said, my price was set for the originals. The prints are actually not too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, a large 20x24 runs about 350.
Yeah. And how did you get into doing this license art for Disney?
Well, there was a lady here, Alicia Oberlander, who used to run the archives at Disney, at DTS and TV. Mm-hmm. And she got hooked up with a company in Burbank that did that sort of thing. And she knew I did illustration. We hooked up randomly after a while, after she had been gone for a while. And she's like, oh, yeah, I have a company. And so bring your stuff by. And it just went from there. She no longer works for this company. But, you know, she hooked me up with my rep, who's primarily in Asia, which was actually good because here the economy had started to kind of soften.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Asia hadn't.
Yeah.
So it was a nice thing. Yeah, it's like I said, you meet people, you talk to them. She wasn't part of production.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you make a friend. And voila.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like, so that opportunity came to you because you were already doing your thing. Doing what you did best. And someone's like, I could use that skill that you have.
Exactly.
To fill my need.
And that's another thing I would say to any artist. Talk about the other things you do.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at DreamWorks, it was when it first opened, so it was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I, at lunchtime, I would watercolor. I would go out and watercolor, or in my office, I'd watercolor.
Yeah.
And someone came by and they really liked what I was doing and they offered me a chance to do development on Shrek and at the time their version of Hobbit and Joseph. So I actually got into development without even having to ask because they just saw what I was doing on the side, which was very different than storyboarding.
Yeah.
So always talk about other things you do. If you are animating a piece, show it to people. Mm. Ask, hey, you want to see what I'm working on? Most of the stuff I do on the side, aside from the Disney stuff, is a little darker than Disney likes. And and I do that to kind of release that side of me a little bit, because you do cutesy stuff for two-year-olds too long and it drives you nuts.
Yeah.
So I break it up a little bit.
Nice. What kind of other side projects do you do for yourself? Like, you mentioned children's books earlier.
Do you do
children's books. Children's books?
Well, I will be. I was doing children's books. My first one was for Simon Schuster. It was about a bunny rabbit. Did pretty good. Story wasn't great, but the book was okay. I did another one for Clarion, which is an offshoot of a larger company. And that was Tough Chicks. And I got both those jobs by going to a convention that they have here in LA and just showing my portfolio just to see. It was just, what the heck. Oh, and I get a call 4 months later. Once again, fell into it. No, I didn't pursue it. And for the Warner Brothers books, I knew someone here who worked in the industry. She had a contact at Warner's Publishing. She had been doing work for them. They asked her to do this project, which she thought was a two-book little pamphlet sort of thing. She couldn't do it. She didn't have time. And we had made an agreement that, oh, well, if you have something that comes along, you can't do trade and vice versa, which is awesome.
That's a nice deal to make.
Yeah, or if the style doesn't fit or whatever. Well, I got in there, and it turned out to be a four-book series for Tweety Bird, and it wasn't written very well, so I told him I can't illustrate this because there's four storylines. Do you mind if I make some suggestions just so I can illustrate it? After the first book, they actually offered me the writing gig, so I wrote the next three and then the following four. And it was for international distribution. They're ebooks now. And it was a good experience, and like I said, it was interesting because they paid their royalties up front because they're trademark characters. You don't get royalties like a normal book, which is why my pay balanced what I was making on the job, which is awesome.
And that's good to know that that's how that works, too. I never knew that.
Yeah, for any trademark, so if you're doing a book for Disney, chances are if it's Mickey Mouse, they'll pay you a higher fee up front. But you won't get royalties on the end.
Too bad, because it probably brings in quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. So they save they money know. By doing it that way. But for me, it was really good. And I am working on a couple of my own books right now. Luckily, because I have been published, I can take my time and approach it in a different way than a non-published artist would be. I still will probably get an agent, because that's just their hoops you got to jump through, and that's fine.
And they can get you more money. Exactly. Agents, especially one that you jive with.
Because, I mean, at this point, I could probably ask for more and not be self-conscious. Yeah. But it's always nice because they know the business better than I do. So I'm working on a couple projects like that. One which may turn into a show pitch. I'm not sure yet. Depends on how it turns out. Right now, it lives in the world of books, and I want it to stay there.
You know, something I just found out is that that's a whole business on its own, is making content to be optioned, like whether you make children's books or books in general. I find that fascinating. Yeah,
merchandising, huge. Learning how to license yourself or your work, huge. That's where money lies, and that's what people don't realize. I mean, you look at Star Wars, and I try to tell people who don't know about it. Star Wars, the actors came in, and they're going to get paid. Well, Harrison Ford, brilliant boy, went up to Lucas and said, well, you're not paying us that much, so here's the deal. Since you can't really pay us what we want, give me 1% of the merchandising.
Wow.
At the time, merchandising wasn't a big thing in movies.
Yeah.
Megabucks. So he knew, or he had a feeling that this might be a way to compensate. And so if I do a character, including the books I've done, part of the contract says if Disney comes to me and wants to use one of the characters I designed for the children's book in a show about that book or whatever, I'm the one who gets paid for that, not the writer. And I get the rights to that character, which means that I get to use it.
And you get final approval on
it. And I get final approval. And it's actually a very friendly way of doing business. It's not as high money as you get in movies, because books don't sell as much. But they're very nice people to work with. Oh, they're so nice. And it's so funny, because I was on like production schedule speed. And so I did the roughs and everything, and I turn them in, and they're like, oh, well, you have 2 more months to do these. I'm like, oh, oops. But they loved it, because they were already behind on the book.
Yeah, nice.
And I'm like, yay. So the schedule is very, the pace is very different. So it's like going from New York to Wyoming.
Yeah. That's so nice. This isn't the end. Melissa has so much to say that we had to cut this episode in two parts. The second half will release in 2 weeks.
The Ink and Paint Girls podcast is produced in Burbank, California. Theme song courtesy of TV's Kyle. Episode edited by Travis Soliday. The views expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of the Walt Disney Company. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Girls podcast. Thanks for tuning in.